Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. In the 6 months since the U.S. left and the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan, the United States has resettled more than 76,000 Afghan refugees. And many of these refugees supported the U.S. as journalists, activists, translators, and humanitarian workers during our nation's lengthy war in the country. Nonprofits and community organizations have pitched in to support as many families as they can while they try to source housing, furnish apartments, enroll children in school, and they often have to rely more heavily on private donations than government funding and support. And while some Afghan families have refugee status, many have recently been admitted into the U.S. under the humanitarian parole. It's a status that allows them immediate entry without visas, but it provides few benefits. For more on this, we're joined now by Krish Omera Vignaraja, who is president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. Krish, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So remind us again about the reason it was so important for so many Afghans to flee the country amid the U.S. troop withdrawal.
Yeah, so we're talking about combat interpreters who served alongside our troops, embassy personnel, who supported our diplomats, women's rights activists, NGO workers, journalists, other vulnerable minorities. They were our close friends and allies for 20 years. They supported our mission, and many of them were in danger precisely because they championed our shared values. So for these people and their families, there just wasn't ever going to be any safety or future under a Taliban regime. And, you know, we obviously saw that in the fear and the desperation, the chaos of the evacuation, families passing babies over barbed wire fences to get them to safety, people clinging to moving aircraft who ultimately fell to their deaths. So for them, they were desperate to get out of the U.S. And it's been incredible. You know, first it was airlifting 124,000 out of Afghanistan, and 76,000 were at-risk Afghans who moved to the safety of American soil.
Tell me how this settlement process here in the U.S. Actually works for these families.
Yeah, so we call it Operation Allies Welcome. They ultimately arrived at 8 military bases here in the U.S. where they were screened, you know, for medical issues, vaccinations. Once they then moved to their final destination, resettlement organizations like Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service help them adjust to life in the U.S. We help them with things like housing, employment, school enrollment, English classes, cultural orientation, and then provide, you know, basic necessities like clothes and food. Really proud to report that there are only a couple hundred left on one of the last military bases, and so they'll leave in the next several days. But we know that successful resettlement and integration doesn't happen in a matter of days or weeks. Our new Afghan neighbors are going to need friendship and support for months and years to come.
There must be value to resettling in a community where there are other members of your home nation, where you speak similar languages, where you know one another. So I'm wondering if Operation Allies Welcome was settling families absolutely individually or in communities.
Yeah, great question. So the way refugee resettlement traditionally happens is there's actually a number of factors that all go into this complex algorithm of deciding where a family or an individual will ultimately resettle. And two of the most important criteria are, is there a strong, concentrated community that could provide a support structure, and or are there U.S. ties? Because states like California, Texas, Virginia have some strong Afghan communities that have grown over, you know, a number of years. Those are certainly areas where you will see a significant number of new Afghan arrivals.
Talk to me a bit about what it's like for Afghan families who are resettling in the U.S. What are some of the biggest challenges they face?
The challenges are many. Both for refugees themselves and for resettlement organizations caring for them. I've met with families, and in every case, they're coming with almost nothing but the clothes on their backs, trying to start over from scratch in a new country after the trauma of losing the only home that they've ever known. We're talking about people who are expected to build a new life in a new country and oftentimes in a new language. We particularly care for vulnerable groups like new mothers with nursing infants, as well as unaccompanied Afghan children. And that's why the resettlement effort is so important, because we can respond to the most urgent needs, but also try to get them on a path to self-reliance. You know, as an organization, we've had to rebuild our capacity almost overnight after the resettlement infrastructure was essentially decimated over, you know, the 4 years of the previous administration. We saw record low refugee admissions, which meant that resettlement organizations had to shut down more than 100 local offices nationwide. LIRS ourselves, we had to close 17. So we've had to aggressively rebuild by hiring new staff, opening new locations. For the Afghans, another major challenge has been housing. We help these families get a roof over their heads, but we're having to do that amid a nationwide shortage of affordable housing. It's complicated in places like California or Northern Virginia, especially where reasonably priced accommodation has been extremely scarce.
I'm wondering about where the other resources come from to raise these structures, to stand them up swiftly enough.
Yeah, so there has been an amazing outpouring of community support from churches, veterans, volunteers. Just yesterday, we received a check from a church that said that was going to use a $50,000 contribution for a capital campaign to expand the church. And they said, you know, as a result of the pandemic, that's not where we need to put these resources right now. We need to help launch an emergency fund for Afghan families. And then we've also had private partners, Airbnb, Uber is another example, as we're trying to get families to doctor's appointments, to meet with their lawyers, to meet with their caseworkers. Uber, for example, has donated thousands of rides to help them. People have stepped up and said, I have a couple bedrooms in my home. Can I help? I have a apartment that's furnished that's not being used. Could you use it? So it's been really, you know, cobbling together a coalition of support.
Do these families have pathways to citizenship or to legal permanent status?
Because of the hurried last-minute evacuation, the majority of evacuees entered the U.S. on a tenuous legal status called humanitarian parole. What a lot of people don't realize is that status doesn't guarantee they'll be able to stay in the U.S. permanently. It provides temporary relief, essentially allows them to stay for up to 2 years and to apply for a work permit. But to access permanent legal status to remain in the U.S., they have to apply for asylum. That's a challenging situation because asylum is a high threshold to meet. It requires a significant amount of documentation to establish a credible claim. And for this specific population, that's a potential catch-22. Many of the allies were encouraged to destroy evidence of their affiliation with the U.S. to avoid Taliban detection and retribution. But that same documentation might be a death sentence in Afghanistan. It could actually be the key to winning an asylum case here in the U.S. Not to mention the asylum system is severely backlogged with about 600,000 pending cases. And that's why we're calling on Congress and the administration to pass what we're calling the Afghan Adjustment Act, which would allow Afghans to apply for a more permanent status.
Just one last question. What can people who are listening do to assist in their own communities?
Yeah, it's an excellent question because this really is an all hands on deck effort. And it's important to realize that resettlement isn't just a sprint, it's a marathon. So we need employers who are open to hiring refugees so that they can take those first steps towards self-sufficiency. We opened a Northern Virginia office, 20 staff, all 20 are Afghan. And I can tell you as an employer, these people, they're talented, they're driven, they're skilled, they're resilient, they're reliable workers. We need volunteers to help with apartment setups. We need people to serve as English tutors so families can navigate life in a new language. We need folks to drive families to doctor's appointments, cultural orientation, other appointments. And then we need advocates to encourage our elected officials to continue to support our Afghan allies. And so there's a number of ways to contribute. And I'd welcome any listeners who are interested in learning more to visit our website at LIRS.org to learn more about getting directly involved in this transformative work.
Krish O'Mara Vignaraja is the president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. Krish, thanks again for joining us.
Really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.